At the Queen's College Chapel in Oxford, England, there is in that beloved chapel a stained glass window. Well, actually, there are many stained glass windows in that chapel, but this morning I have one in mind in particular, one which we have reproduced for you on the front cover of your bulletin this morning. It is the Ascension window. Now, usually, Ascension windows are stately, magisterial, Jesus surrounded by angels, sometimes with wings, but the Queen's College window is, well, almost a bit whimsical. It depicts a little group of shocked disciples at the bottom of the window, staring up to the very top to a little storm cloud from which protrude a pair of pinky white feet with a bit of purple robe around them. That's all you can see of Jesus in this window. It's just his feet, as though Jesus is lifting off into orbit. In the ethereal space of the Queen's Chapel, the scene is almost laughable. It is funny, after all, given the comparisons with other Ascension windows in other cathedrals. And it's odd to think of, particularly in these days when our cosmology has long discarded the three-story universe. I'm not sure I've thought much about it across the years at all, about what the Ascension of Jesus means. We still speak of the Ascension with some frequency, nonetheless. The third day he rose again from the dead, he ascended into heaven, we say in the Creed. So we say every time we say the Apostles' Creed, he ascended into heaven. It's a hard picture to get into our heads, especially on a day when the only picture in our minds is that those dangling feet. Barbara Brown Taylor says almost everything else that happened to Jesus makes sense in terms of my own life. He was born to a human mother, and so was I. He ate and drank and slept at night, so do I. He loved people, and he got angry with people, and he forgave people, and so have I. He wept, me too. He died, and I will die too. He rose from the dead, and I even know something about that because I've had some Easter mornings of my own, joy found in the midst of deep sorrow, life in the midst of death. But ascending into heaven to be seated at the right hand of God, that is where Jesus and I part company. That is where he leaves me in the dust. My only experience of the Ascension is from the ground, my neck cranked upward, back as far as it will go, my mouth wide open, my face shielded from the sun by the cloud that is bearing my Lord away. It's an odd scene. What are we to make of it? Well, it might be helpful to remember the context of this story. Luke says that our risen Lord gathered his disciples after Easter to prepare them for their future without him. There was a crisis to be overcome, a crisis of their discipleship and what they would do when they could no longer see or hear Jesus or draw strength from his physical presence among them. The time of instruction went on for 40 days, Luke says, and then Jesus made a promise to them. He said, "Wait in Jerusalem for the promise of the Father." The promise, he said, was the power of the Spirit. Their job was to wait for that power, to wait for God to act according to the promise. It's not the Ascension that's at the center of this story, friends, as intriguing as that is, but rather the promise that remains with the disciples and the promised power that eventually will propel the church and ensure the progress of the gospel. The truth, says Acts scholar Beverly Gaventa, is that in both the gospel that was his first volume and here in Acts, Luke is focused on the promises of God. There was the promise made to Zechariah and Elizabeth of a son in the midst of Elizabeth's barrenness, a son named John, who would turn many to the Lord. There is Gabriel's disturbing yet remarkable promise to Elizabeth's kinswoman, Mary, that she too would bear a son and call him Jesus, who would be the Son of the Most High. There is the promise of the angels to shepherds, keeping their watch over their flocks in the pastures above Bethlehem. There is the word of promise at Jesus' baptism, the declaration of God's pleasure over that one. There is the word of promise that Jesus speaks at the beginning of his ministry when he cites the prophet Isaiah to point to his own mission and to say that he has come to bring good news to the poor and to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty the oppressed, and to proclaim the year of God's favor. And now, in this second volume, Luke begins again with a reminder of the promises of God. And the rest of the book details the fulfillment of those promises. Despite all their prior history of promise, the disciples don't grasp what it is that Jesus is saying to them at the time. Clearly, they don't quite understand. And that fact becomes clear just after the ascension itself. Despite having heard Jesus' instructions, after witnessing Jesus' ascent into the clouds, they just stand there staring into heaven, mouths agape, as though afflicted with what a friend calls some sort of ascension deficit disorder. Yeah, I'm sorry, I know. But it's only when they are prompted by two angelic visitors that they move from the spot. Taylor says that in the wake of that prompting, something remarkable happens. They all stop looking at the sky, and they begin to look at one another. On the surface, it was not a great moment. 11 abandoned disciples with nothing to show for all their following. But in the days and years to come, it would become very apparent what had happened to them. With nothing but a promise and a prayer, those 11 people consented to become the church. And nothing was ever the same again, beginning with them. The followers became leaders. The listeners became preachers. The converts became missionaries. The healed became healers. The disciples became apostles, witnesses of the risen Lord by the power of the Holy Spirit. And nothing was ever the same again. It began to turn, I think, when they returned to Jerusalem, all of them. In those days, said Luke, all of them were constantly devoting themselves to prayer. Gaventa notes, if this closing scene in our passage makes no reference to God's promises, it does demonstrate that the apostles have learned their lesson. Instead of waiting impatiently for this dramatic return of Jesus, they finally do as they were told in the first place. They wait. Something good may yet come from them. Their waiting is not passive here. The apostles gather with women who had followed Jesus. They engage in prayer. Soon they will seek a replacement for Judas, and they wait for the promises to be fulfilled. Pentecost, which we will celebrate next Sunday, fulfills the promise of the Holy Spirit. Events in Jerusalem initiate the promise of the witness, and then surprising things begin to happen. They begin to say things that sound like Jesus. They begin to do things that they have never seen anyone but him do before. They become brave and capable and even wise. Whenever two or three of them get together, it's always as if there is someone else in the room with them, a strong, abiding presence, as available to them as bread and wine, as familiar to them as each other's faces. It's almost as if he had not ascended, but rather exploded, so that all the holiness that was once concentrated in him alone flew everywhere, flew far and wide, so that the seeds of heaven were sown in the fields, all the fields of the earth. What the apostles and we learn through it all is that God's promises can be trusted. Those promises are often fulfilled in unexpected ways and are sometimes met with great resistance. That the hostile Paul would become an instrument in fulfilling God's promises is not at first welcome news. Peter himself could scarcely imagine that the promise of a witness to the ends of the earth would lead him to baptize the household of the Gentile Cornelius. God's promises can be trusted, even if God fulfills those promises in astonishing and sometimes even offensive ways. Now, all of us make promises. Promises that are full of good intentions. A parent tells a child who is still shaking from a nightmare that she won't ever let anything harm the child, not imagining all the traumas or tragedies that that child may have to face across the years. A young couple stands before a congregation of family and friends and say to one another that together they will persevere through sickness and health, through all kinds of circumstances of plenty and want, unable to perceive the stresses that a serious illness or a lost job, much less the day-to-day togetherness may bring and impose upon their promise. Dear friends who have managed a lot together promise that they will always be there for each other without calculating the toll that years and divergent paths and political realities will take on their friendships. An elder-elect stands before the church and declares her assent to the ordination question that asks, "Do you promise to further the peace, unity, and purity of the church?" Not yet fully understanding the fragility of that precarious balance she has promised to help secure. Changing circumstances and demands, like our own frailties and faults, sometimes place even the best promises we make beyond our grasp. The fact that God does keep promises does not make our own promises more reliable. Neither does God's trustworthiness make our failures less painful to us or to others. What God's trustworthiness does mean is that our broken promises are never the last word about us. God promises that something good may come from us yet, as it did from the disciples. So, about the ascension. Don't just stand there looking up at those dangling feet. Look around. Consider the promises of God you see at work in those around you, empowering the church even now, even today. Consider the gifts God has given you to God and given to God's people across the centuries and even today, and the promise such gifts portend for the future of Christ's church. In waiting, in prayer, may we yet be open to the Spirit and to that Spirit's remarkable and sometimes disturbing power to open doors that have long been shut.